today, or rather yesterday, we were talking just about general principles of meditation, especially things like learning how to let go, put things down, be patient, and wait for things to become still. And not interfering, having the idea that the mind, you, whatever it looks at, whatever it tries to manipulate, always disturbs the meditation, not enhances it. And our job is just to be a passive observer and then wait for things to happen. And it reminded me of a story that when I first was a Buddhist, there weren't hardly any places you could do meditation retreats in this country. And so sometimes I'd go up to Sandy Ling in Scotland in 1970 or something, and sometimes that there was a little monastery in Throstlehall. And I didn't care whether it was Theravada, whether it was Mahayana or Zen or whatever, as long as I could do some meditation, I was really into it. But when I went to the retreat center, not retreat center, I suppose, what do you call it? I call it a priory. Anyway, it's Throstle Hall in the north of England. I was surprised because I'd never done a Zen meditation retreat before. And of course, there they did use the Zen stick. But of course, I was fortunate. I'd always been a very lucky young Buddhist. Because that it was the gentleman sitting next to me who got hit first. And that took away all my sleepiness. I was never sleepy at all after that. But that was not the reason I wanted to bring this meditation retreat in that place up, because we were told to sit with your eyes open and look at a whitewashed wall. It's an old barn. And of course, I'd never done that type of meditation before. I'd always been taught to keep your eyes closed. There's a lot of advantages in meditating with your eyes closed. It means that everybody else is doing meditation with you. They can scratch their ears or scratch places. You don't get upset because no one can see you, except for me. You've got the camera on them all the time. But interesting, you know, that I went to, this is totally by the way, I went to a big ceremony in the, I think it was Sydney Anglican Cathedral many years ago with Queen Elizabeth. And because I was one of the presenters, who was sitting almost opposite Queen Elizabeth, just like from you to me here. And I found out one of her secrets. If you ever notice on formal ceremonies, the Queen always wears a hat with a big long brim. No reason why? It's because when she starts to go to sleep, the brim covers her eyes so you can't see that she's nodding off. And if you heard the sermon from the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, you would have nodded off too. So you see how it goes down, she's nodding off. No one can see shutting her eyes, so she doesn't get embarrassed. Anyway, in this retreat, you had to keep your eyes open, staring at a wall, and what to do? I was given no instructions. The fortunate part of this story was I'd already learned enough meditation to be in the present moment and to keep my mind silent. No commentary. Not fantasizing, dreaming, planning, or figuring things out. Just to have this very peaceful mind, just observing. See what happens. And of course, unexpected things happen then. Because I was in this moment not thinking, I was watching this wall, and then, it vanished. It disappeared. There's no wall there anymore. my eyes were fully open and the wall disappeared. That was so cool. Remember, this was 60s, 70s, when weird stuff was always really cool. So, number one, when these things happen in meditation, do not be afraid. They're fascinating. And the wall disappeared for quite a few minutes, and then it came back again. I thought, what on earth is happening? Have they put some mushrooms in the pond? The magic ones. And now, using your after experiences, then you explore them, then you try and get some insight out of them. And the insight which I got out of that was, it's just the nature of the senses, that they're only wired to notice things which change. And when things stay the same, just you can't notice them, the brain turns off. And this insight, I was just watching a white wall, it wasn't changing. And the marvellous efficiency of the brain, just staring at it for quite a few minutes, meant the brain realised nothing to do, nothing going on, and it just energy saved. Just like your computers. If you don't press anything or click anything, the screen turns off. That's so similar to the way your senses operate. And that explains a lot about what this meditation is all about. How we turn off the senses, the five senses, to reveal that secret sense, the mind, through stillness. So turning off the sense of sight is pretty simple. Close your eyes. And as long as there's not bright lights in front of you, nothing penetrates the barrier of those eyelids. So after a very short while, you're not seeing the inside of your eyelids. You're not seeing anything at all. The sense of sight turns off. Smelling? As long as the aroma, the smell of the meditation hall stays the same, then you don't smell anything. It's one of the reasons why that any people with bad digestion who are likely to pass wind, we always put them in the seats in the back. Don't worry. So if they do pass wind, it's only the wall can smell. But please, if you've got those, don't sit in the front, because that means many people behind you will be disturbed from this. But anyway, the sense of smell, very simply, very easily turns off. Taste? Can you taste your saliva? It's always there, but stays the same, after a while, turns off. And that leaves these other two senses, which are extremely difficult to turn off. The bodily sensations, feeling, touch, and also sound. It's very difficult to turn off. But first of all, the physical sensations, which is one of the reasons why we try to sit comfortably as we can, so that the physical sensations can actually, there's nothing going on there. So the mind feeling safe can just turn off that physical sense and your body experiences start to disappear. And I recall teaching this meditation in Singapore once, and this gentleman, it's only a day's meditation, got really concerned that during the meditation he couldn't feel his hands. His hands started to disappear. Yay! And that's the first time he'd experienced that, and it was scary for him. He thought there was some medical condition. He said, no, this is normal. And after a while, everything else will start to disappear. So you can't feel your butt, you can't feel your legs, you can't feel your back, you can't feel your head, you can't feel anything. And remember that story I said about the mosquitoes in Thailand? learning how to turn off the sense of touch was a wonderful thing to be able to do when you're in such difficulties. You know, with whatever touch you experience was always really irritating. You can actually do that. Because what happens is the sense of touch, nothing much is going on there, so it totally turns off. It disappears. Of course, then you're left with the sense of hearing. And the sense of hearing is extremely difficult to turn off because that's our safety system, that's our alarm system. It's one of the reasons why when you're asleep, the sense of sense which turns off on, first of all, the alarm clock, someone knocking on your door, saying time to get up, time to get up, that penetrates the mind more than anything else. Trying to shake somebody awake is never as powerful as just the alarm clock. So the sense of sound is very difficult to turn off. But as long as you feel safe, as long as there's not a change in sound, what we call the ambient sound remains the same, then very easy for the sense of sound to actually be so still, it vanishes and turns off. So your five senses are becoming still and disappearing. And that allows your sixth sense, the mind, to become clear. So this is one of the reasons why you practice this stillness for the sake of the disappearance of these five external senses. You don't need to be in a cave. You can be sort of close to traffic, to the aircraft overhead, but as long as it's not a sudden, loud noise, as long as the ambient, the average sound remains pretty much the same, then there's no problem. So why do we do that? This was based on a simile of the Buddha, but of course changed most of the details. Once there was an emperor, and the emperor would often appear in public, but would always be clothed in the five garments, always covered head to toe, first of all in these boots, which went up to the thighs, and then trousers which overlapped the top of the boots up to the waist, and up to the waist. Then a jacket which overlaps the top of the trousers with sleeves down to the wrists and a high collar. And then gloves which overlap the wrists of the jacket, and lastly a helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket and covered all the head. So five garments, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet, totally obscuring the emperor. So no one knew who that emperor was, whether it was male or female, whether it was whatever race, age, no one could know who was in charge. It was always obscured by the five pieces of clothing. And that's the simile for you. The emperor is your mind. This thing which has so much power and cause so much happiness and also pain and suffering. But do you really know what your mind is? Because every time it appears, it's clothed in the five garments called the five senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. So in order to truly find out what this emperor is, you have to take off its clothes. In order for you to find out what this sixth sense is all about, you have to let sight turn off. Sound becomes so still you can't hear anything. Smell and taste disappear. And your body, with its sense of touch, also turns off.
totally vanish. That is scary for many people because that's what we think protects us. And I was telling somebody yesterday, you do not have to be scared at all, because once those five senses disappear, it seems weird. I like the weird stuff in meditation, as you probably know, because you become invulnerable. There was, this is from the suttas first of all, there was a monk in the time of the Buddha who was meditating in the forest when two villagers came by and they saw that monk sitting so still. Too still, they thought he had passed away. And being Buddhist, they thought, it's not right just to let this poor monk who's now passed away, who's dead, be eaten by the jungle animals. So we should do the funeral for him. So being in the forest, it was easy to collect some wood and put the venerable monk on top. And then they did some chanting, probably not the right chanting, but still was some chanting, whatever they thought was appropriate. And they lit the funeral pyre. And being very busy, just like today, you can't hang around all day, sort of, at a funeral for a monk, you don't know. So they did their bit, and then they went off to do their work, collecting mushrooms or herbs or whatever from the forest. They cremated him. But you can imagine their surprise and their inspiration to see that very same monk come on arms round in the morning. Not even his robe was singed. He was invulnerable. So, if during this retreat you see, say, Ayachandra sitting perfectly still here, doesn't matter if you want to cremate her. She'll be uncrematable. You'll take her, put her in the oven, in an ice box. And after the funeral, whatever it is, the guy does the cremations, opens the oven again, there will be Venerable Chanda smiling, hi! Totally untouched by the fire. But that was in the suttas. A bit about Ayachandra, that was something extra, obviously. But in the present day, or maybe just a few years ago, you may have heard me say that when people do have these special abilities, we usually don't say anything about it until they've passed away. The reason is so that they don't get stand out above the Sangha, so they don't get special attention, so that they can live peacefully and only afterwards be let on what they were doing and what sort of abilities they had. But this man, which I got to know, he was Indonesian. His name was Sudama. He started off his life just going into the jungles to try to be a rishi, like a hermit sage, not so joining any religion. But he went deep into the jungles of Java when the jungles were still there, before the huge urbanization of that big island. And he found a nice quiet spot, sat down and meditated. And his experience, is which he told me personally, was interesting in that he was fluent in English, but he used words in a unique way. Because he said he was sitting there in the jungles, really peaceful, and he said this star came to him in his mind, brilliant star, and he said, the word I always remember, he married that star. And this was typical of like great nimittas, beautiful lights appear in the mind, and you go into that. Nimitta unite with it, or in his case, he married it. That was the best English he could say to describe his experience. And he was in there for many days. And when he came out of his meditation, he didn't have any watch or iPad or anything like that in those days. So he didn't know how long he'd been in the deep meditation. What he did notice when he came out was that the forest, the jungle around him, was different. As many trees were broken, there was lots of damage in that area. And so he came out of meditation, walked the nearest village and asked what had happened. There had been a flood, a flash flood in that area. And the damage he saw was from the flooding. And the currents in the rivers or whatever was flowing in that area. And all that time he worked out, he would have been under a few feet of water for days. No damage at all. Because that's what happens in those deep meditations. Invulnerable. I know that monk. He passed away only recently. Of old age, not of flooding, not of anything else. And it's the same with even recently, when a few, 2 years ago, I think it was a year and a half ago, when I went over to Sri Lanka for the conference. That was a global conference. No, not a global conference, it was some conference or whatever. Yes, I was at the World Buddha Summit. And one of my disciples over there, I was staying in one of these hotels, in a small hotel room. He said, "Can I come up just to pay my respects?" That was time. I said, "Oh, well, okay." Only paying respects, only just a couple of bows and he was off. So I thought. But then, as soon as I opened the door, there was a whole heap of people outside wanting to come in. It was his meditation group, about 15 or 16 of them. So they all crowded into a small room. And so he did a bit of meditation, but then he also just told me one of the stories of one of his star meditators. And first of all, to say that the chief of this group, he was a doctor, a surgeon. I think he was employed by one of the branches of the military as a doctor. But in his spare time, that he was a meditation teacher, following my methods. And he said one of his students was really easy to get into these deep meditations. So he decided to do an experiment on him while he was in jhana. Being a doctor, he took out his instruments. He swabbed this person's arm and with the scalpel tried to make an incision on the arm. He was videoing it. The scalpel would not go in. Scalpel couldn't penetrate the skin at all, even though it was really sharp. Invulnerable. But then, just to prove what was going on, that on the next meditation, he asked this young man, "Would you mind if I try this again, this time with your permission?" He said, "Yes." And so, video going again. This time with permission from the meditator. Then he took out the scalpel and made an incision with no problem at all. Of course, there was no feeling in that, no screaming or any sign of any pain because he just left his body and had gone into deep meditations. I don't mean physically leaving your body, but transcended, got past it. He made an incision, blood came out, swabbed the blood, stitch up the wound, put a sterile bandage on it, and they carried on meditating. The only difference is, first time, no permission granted to injure him. Second time, permission granted. Weird, the power of samadhi on your body. You become invulnerable. So, I only say that, not because it's weird, to say that because sometimes people feel afraid when these big things happen. Do not feel afraid, you are perfectly safe. And also, they have other side effects as well. That sometimes people are really sick, Ajahn Chah. Like many of those monks in that time suffered from malaria fever. Because living in the forest, it was just something you had to deal with, like coughs or flus. It was just almost unavoidable. So every forest monk would have malaria fever from time to time. And of course, he went into a deep meditation, Ajahn Chah, in Tenmi. And he sort of told me that it was like being in the middle of a forest fire, really hot, and he was right in the middle of it, and it got hotter and hotter and hotter, but being in the middle, it was really cool. Hotter and hotter and hotter, until it got so hot, the heat exploded. And that was the last time he ever had a malaria fever. And these deep meditations have wonderful effects. Healing gift. So these are just trying to reassure you that when you go and see this emperor, you are incredibly safe. You don't need just to, oh, am I going to survive this? Is this going to work? They are really, really safe. And that's how we understand the nature of this mind, which is powerful. So that's also the reason why, through stillness, things vanish. And then you get underneath them and see, you know, what's really there. The Buddha simile, for anyone who's interested, was the goldsmith. If you get some gold that you don't know its properties until you purify it of everything else except for gold, 100% gold, nothing else, then you can examine it and know its properties. The only way you can really understand the nature of your mind is to purify it from these five senses until there's just the mind and nothing else. Then you can understand exactly what's there. So in that way of calming, we calm the body down as much as we possibly can. The two difficult ones is physical touch, because the body is always doing something. And what I'm going to do now is I look at the audience here. Someone just lifted their head up. Someone is just scratching their moustache, somebody's picking their nose, somebody just moving their legs to get them comfortable, somebody's just moving their bottom to get comfortable on the chair, somebody just also scratched their nose, somebody just moved their hand to a different position. We're all doing something with our body, and we take it for granted that it's normal. We don't even notice the way we keep on moving. The reason is because this body is always constantly irritating and getting us to do things. Now imagine sitting perfectly still, comfortably still, physically. You don't need to scratch anything. You don't need to adjust this or wiggle that. You're totally, that's very rare to see that. That's how hard it is to bring the body to stillness. Even in sleep, people toss and turn. So to be able to get their body perfectly still is a wonderful thing to achieve and to see. It doesn't move anymore. But there was an easy way, so I thought. When the first of these sensory deprivation chambers came out, these were these flotation tanks, where you could be in salty water, which was just at your body temperature, and you could just float in really easily. So imagine that, instead of sitting here with an achy bottom and pain in your legs and cold or too hot, there you were just floating, totally supported by the water, nice and warm, the most comfortable you think you could ever be in your body. It still itches. There's still things need to be scratched. You can't get rid of that. Which is one of the reasons why the flotation chambers is never as great as learning how to sit down reasonably comfortable and then letting go so you can't feel the aches and pains in your body. And you can do that in any physical situation. Don't like telling too many personal stories, but this one I've already told many times. When I was 1 or 2 years as a monk, contracted typhus, scrub typhus. Doctors at that time didn't know it existed in that part of Thailand because all the locals had developed immunity and it's only the Westerners who came there had no immunity. So we were getting this very high fevers, which everyone thought was typhoid. And that you were put in hospital because it's a really bad disease, and no energy at all, and just given any antibiotic, just hit and miss to see what would work. And it was very unpleasant because in the monk's ward of a regional hospital, and in that monk's ward I remember going there the very first day, and at 6 p.m. the nurse at the nurse's station just went out and never came back. 6:30, 7 o'clock, 7:30, there was no one there at all. And I mentioned to the monk and the next bed, should we get someone today? The night nurse hasn't come. And he looked at me and said, night nurse? There is no night nurse. For 12 hours of the day, we're on our own. If anything just goes wrong, any medical emergency, it's just bad karma. You know, that was not reassuring at all. So, if ever you go to the National Health Service, don't complain. Compared to that place, that is so safe and luxurious. But even worse, the only, therapy or cure they were proposing was injections of antibiotics, cocktails of antibiotics, administered in my backside twice a day by a nurse who was nothing like the petite nurses you see on Thai Airways. This nurse was built like a water buffalo. Honestly, she had to be. And the reason why, because you had to inject you twice a day. And this was not the days of the one-use, super-sharp needles. These were, many of you may remember the old times, had these old needles, which they had to steam to try and sterilize them. And I'm pretty sure, because this was a really third-world backwoods hospital, that they had used those needles in Bangkok first of all, and then instead of just throwing them away to send them up to Ubon, and they'd be used to expensive or the rich patients first of all, and last of all sent to the monk's ward, because we were supposed to be tough. And honestly, those were really dull needles. So much so that every day it was never injected. Stabbed. And after a few days, I was really sore bottom. And with all of my meditation and being a Buddhist monk and being kind and emphasizing compassion, there was no way, it was totally beyond me, to give loving kindness to that nurse. It was. I hated it. Sorry, that was okay for me. But anyway, nothing worked. Week after week with the fever, getting tired, more and more tired. And then Ajahn Chah would come to see me. He came to see me once. This is that story. my great compassionate master. And you feel so uplifted for a few seconds until he opens his mouth. Honest. Brahma once, though, he said, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then he left. Now, can you imagine being really sick? I mean, really sick. You know, it was been terrible for weeks. And then your master comes and sees you and he says that. It was even worse than I could argue with that. He was right. His wisdom was wonderful, but his bedside manner had a lot to be desired. So there you were, just a Westerner in a hospital a long way away. Just really sort of, the treatment was just something which was totally which you never thought you'd receive. And then one day I thought, stop complaining. Start meditating, for goodness sake. And that was where, in the middle of a fever, absolutely no energy at all, just decided to just go inside my body, instead of just worrying about my body, to do some meditating. You see the body, keep it pretty still, let it disappear, and go inside. And if you seem to be getting into a deep meditation now is fun, imagine when you compare that to being just so weak, feverish, and then going into something which was so much more beautiful and wonderful, just freedom. It was wonderful being able to do that and come out afterwards. And I'm pretty sure the fever had gone after that. No fever left. Disease stopped. Power of samadhi is immense. So anyway, still, this is what happens. You get out of the way, it allows the body to do what it needs to do. That's a nice little segue to some of these amazing sort of cures, health benefits of meditation. On one of the retreats, I've been teaching retreats for so many years, but one of these retreats that I was, when I just went out, actually, before I went out, some of the retreat manager, I think, whispered in my ear, you better open your eyes, because one of the retreatants was distorted. But she had her body twisted so badly. Usually I try and demonstrate it. If I demonstrated how she was sitting, you'd have to send me to the hospital too. It was really extreme. And the retreat manager said, look, you better stop her meditating like that. She'll have to leave this place in a wheelchair by what she's doing to her body right now. And so I waited actually until she came out of meditation. And then afterwards I said, how do you feel? She said, wonderful. I feel so great. I said, did you realize how you're sitting meditating? No, I was meditating, normal posture. She said, no, you weren't. You're really twisted. She said, I feel great now. And of course, Tubhada Jambram had to connect the dots, say, ah, yeah, okay, I understand what's going on. When did you have your car crash? Ah, I said, well, you really have got psychic powers. I never told you that. It was not psychic powers. So I've noticed many, many times that your body, when you are in a reasonably deep state of meditation, it will move, it will twist, because it knows which position it needs to take to get the energies rolling through the system to heal it. And the most common form of injuries on the back was some sort of car crash or whiplash. And when she was out of the way, not controlling her body, she twisted around, or rather the body did it, twisted around to make it possible for those energies to go to where they were needed to do the healing which was required. Seen that many, many times. That was the most extreme. She felt great afterwards. Problem solved. A lot of time, when we try to control things, we stop the body doing what it needs to do. It's one of the reasons why in deep meditation, when we're letting go of the body, it's amazing just the health benefits which come up. So, don't be afraid of letting go. stillness and these things vanish. So how does this stillness happen when you have a flotation chamber? You sit here and it's hard to let go of the body. So what we do is we let go most of the body. So if you'll be with something like the breathing is like a stepping stone. From this body to the breath, from the breath to the mind. So we put all our attention on the breath first of all. And from the breath, then the breath vanishes and we're in the realm of the mind. One of those reasons we do that is because when the sound disappears, when the body starts to calm down, the breath is the only thing left moving. Everything else stops or is not really perceived. Yes, the heart is still pumping, but we try not to pay too much attention on that so we can stay with the breathing. And because you're just with the breath, the only thing left which is actually changing is everything else disappears. That is actually where we calm the breath down. It happens naturally because you're not metabolizing, because you're not needing much oxygen, the breath gets very smooth, very light, and then it starts to vanish. So we go to the realm of the mind. So that's the little trick of meditation of Anapanasati. And I mentioned this Anapanasati. Pana means the breath. Sati, mindfulness. Ana means along with. Mindfulness along with the breath. And please excuse me, but the Buddha never ever taught Anapanasati. You know Anapanasati? Mindfulness along with pain. Being aware of pain. No, just Anapana, the breath. So all that pain business just vanishes. So you're just with the breath. Once you're with the breath, then the breath starts to get delightful and beautiful. And that gives you the path into the realm of the mind. So, many of you have done breath meditation, I hope. Once you start with the breath meditation soon, that's all you're aware of is the breathing and you can't feel the body. Or even doing the walking meditation, lifting your feet, moving them forward, putting them down, then the next foot. And as you do walking meditation, after a while you too get into this beautiful state of mind where you're in your own little bubble, just because there's so many sensations just in one step of your feet, lifting it up and moving it forward and putting it down. Just one step has so many different things to watch. And if anyone has been unfortunate enough to have a stroke and had to learn how to walk again, you know exactly what I mean. Walking is just one of the most complicated physical activities, comprising of so many different movements. We take it for granted, but when we do walking meditation, so many different movements. And after a while, those movements of just one step become so fascinating, we can't hear much else, or see much else. We're zooming in. And what happened to me was I was walking meditation in Bangkok, noisy place, but really getting into it. So foot was lifting up and moving forward. It usually becomes slow because there's too many things going on to actually to go fast. It's a natural. But don't force it. If you force doing slow walking meditation, then it looks really weird. So strange that story of... Actually, you remember the story of Chittos, that first year? When there was a site... There's many stories, I'm going to tell that story now. This is when there was a local who lived just in a village towards the south, somewhere close to the South Downs, where she was a clinical psychiatrist. She was the head doctor of a facility, could have been in Chichester, I'm not sure, for those with mental impairments. but she had a big house, and she made it available for a weekend retreat. And so, there were many people came for that weekend retreat, and as is a custom in many countries, when you go on a retreat, you keep 8 precepts and you wear white clothes. And, you see, only lady there is wearing white, so that's typical when you go to the temple. So, all the retreatants were wearing white clothes. When it came to walking meditation, they went out in the garden doing their walking meditation, all wearing white. And there was one of these typical bored, nosy, middle-aged women in the village who would pull the curtains aside and see what's going on. And she pulled the curtains aside, and in this woman's house, number one, she was known to be a clinical psychiatrist working in the local institution for those with mental impairments. And she saw all these people in white moving slowly. What did she do? Ring 999. Complain to the police that this doctor had brought her patients home. And so that lovely poor Natasumato, you know, had to argue with the police. No, these are meditators. They haven't seen meditators before. They're wearing white, moving very, very slowly. That's what had happened. So in those days, you know, that wears different coloured clothing or something. In my monastery, there was another group that were doing the slow walking meditation. And this time, they didn't think it was that someone had brought patients from the mental institutions to the monastery. This time, it was a Sri Lankan family and their 2 kids. Can we please have a look at your retreat center? Yeah, sure, as long as you don't make any noise. And they came to have a look, and then they came back immediately afterwards to see me because the children were just so scared. Said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to go to that retreat center. Why? It's been taken over by zombies. Apparently zombies were in every film recently. Zombie invasion or Walking Dead or something. Because apparently a zombie walks really mindfully. And the kids have been watching too many zombie movies, and they saw these slow walking meditators, and they could not tell the difference. The retreat center had been taken over by zombies, call the police or something. So anyway, but this ordinary walking meditation. But when you do that, when I was doing that, you just got so into your own world. Just so focused inside. Not trying to focus, just happens. So what occurred next? I was usually, we did the walking meditation for an hour. Went on for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes. I heard this amazing sound. Like coming from 100 miles away. Wow, wow, so. That's really weird. Wow, wow, so. And I realized there was another monk shouting in my ear hole about this far away. Because I'm supposed to go to an appointment to one of these ceremonial alms offerings. And I'd forgotten all about it. And my preceptor sent this monk to come and get me. And there he saw me, just you know, zombified. And he was trying to catch my attention. You had to really shout to penetrate you know, whatever samadhi I had. And I remember that because it shows you just how peaceful and quiet you can get in your meditation. It's when you know you start allowing the mind to become still. So, when this happens, please enjoy it. Okay. So, but if ever there is a distraction, a nice simple method to overcome distractions when you are meditating. Sounds, people moving, even itches and aches in the body. And that is, there's many advantages when you go on aircraft flying all over the world. And this simile I got from sitting in economy class, seeing this little video thing, a screen, in front of me, and having to see the in-flight video, a safety video. And there I was, just watching this in-flight safety video. Your safety is important to us. Actually, because of that, I'd never ever fly Qantas anymore. Other airlines fly, but never ever Qantas. You know why? It's always turbulent on Qantas. It's always the most bumpy ride of all aircraft. Because that's why it's called the flying kangaroo. But you saw this screen, and when the in-flight safety video came on, I just noticed something. That when the screen lit up, I couldn't see the upholstery beyond the edge of the plastic rim of the screen. As if the image there had actually drawn my attention in. And that answered a question. Why is that sometimes, even these days, you see people watching a movie now on their iPhone? How on earth can you do that? It's so small. I remember the movie on these big screens in cinemas. I see people with these huge TVs in their rooms. Does that make watching the movie more interesting? Or can you watch a movie just on an iPad and still get the same rewards? Yes, you can. The reason is because once you start watching, your mind zooms in and fits perfectly into the screen. And everything on the outside falls off the screen. And that gave me a wonderful little technique. Whenever I was meditating with sound, I'd made sure the sound, I never brought that into the center of my screen. I kept my mind on the breathing, the sound was over here somewhere. And so after a while, as I zoomed in more and more to the breathing, the sound fell off the screen. But if I was really concerned about who made that sound and what that sound is and when it's going to stop, it's like I moved the sound into the center of my screen, the distraction was in the center of the screen, and my breath was somewhere over here somewhere. And of course that would fall off pretty soon. I always made sure my main meditation object was in the center of the idea of having a screen of attention. And everything else, every other distraction was on the edge. The fever, when I had the typhus fever, mosquitoes biting, I never put them in the center, never gave them that much importance. On the edge somewhere. The breath was most important, kept it on there. And even the heartbeat. Sometimes when you get into deep meditations, you can see your heart start beating. Excitement, usually, or fear. Natural response. Keep my mind on the breathing, on if it's a light or never, to keep it on there, right in the center. Hear the heart pump, 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 pump. If I try to calm my heartbeat down, come on, soft and soft and soft, until the heartbeat stopped, then I'll be in big trouble. So instead, I kept my center on the breathing, the heartbeat was over there doing its thing, and then it would soon vanish. I never centered on it, I never gave it that importance. So the idea of a screen of attention, whatever you have in the center will remain, and you will zoom in on it. Whatever's on the edges will disappear, sooner or later. That is how we focus. Not through force, through actually choosing what's in the center and making sure distractions don't come in and surprise it. Okay. Now, I know there were so many questions in the box. I just put my hand in and just picked out a few, just at random. just at the end of this talk I can do a couple of questions. Is that okay? Thank you very much for your wonderful teachings. I'll stop there. Okay, I'll do that. Could you please give a teaching or any advice on how to reduce one's self-identification with the five candles, the five components of existence? The self-identification, my candles. If they really are your candles, that's body, feeling, or what I say, experience, perception, will, and consciousnesses. Do you think they really are yours? If they were mine, I'd have much more power over them. And I'd be able to say to my body, come on body, don't feel tired. Don't feel sick. The thing is, that's what it means by being mine. And it's also, is that really who you are? Your body? People know that you're not your body. If I was really was my body, you can see, if that was my sense of self, you can see just how big a self which I have got. You can tell if a person's got a big self, because they refuse to laugh at themselves. I totally humiliate my body at times. I tell people, and Mel Chanda knows this, one of the reasons why I have a big tummy like this is for safety. If I trip and fall, I don't fall on the face, hits my tummy first of all, and bounces up. So that's how it works. It's very good. When I was travelling in the United States, going through some immigration customs, the customer said, what have you got under your robe, sir? And then, is it a suicide belt? I said, no, it's only fat. He said, same thing. And sometimes I said, no. But you know, you always have like an icon you want to live up to. Someone inspires you so much, you think, maybe later on in my life, that's who I'd like to be. That's who I aspire to. And my icon I spent all my whole life aspiring towards, not Ajahn Chah, it was someone I saw when I was really young. This fellow, he was a fellow. He was so kind, always jolly and laughing, and the most generous person you'd ever think of. And he was fat, he was older when I was young. And he's still alive today, I still see him in the shops every Christmas. Santa Claus! Is Santa Claus thin? No, he's always fat and jolly and so kind and generous. So he is the one I'm aspiring for. Santa Claus. But on that, there is one important point. If you are of ample girth, you better have a good sense of humour and be happy and laughing. Have you ever noticed that fat people are always jolly? The reason is because the fat, miserable ones died a long time ago. And there's a scientific reason for that. When you laugh, when you have a positive mindset, always being critical and negative and angry, when you laugh and are happy, your blood vessels, they dilate, they expand. So I've been laughing my head off for such a long time that my blood vessels are just so expanded. I can eat anything, and there's never a traffic jam. You know, on the M25, they have to expand the number of lanes so there's no congestion. And that's when my blood vessels are so expanded, they are wider than the M25, so nothing ever gets stuck, which is why they survive. So the fat, visible people, they're the ones who've got lots of gut going through their system, and their blood vessels are tiny. Of course they're going to get clogged and have strokes and heart attacks. But if you are happy and right, expanding your arteries, which means you can eat more of what you really like, and there's no problem. It's been working for me so far. Anyway, what's the next part of the question? Self-identification with five candies. So I just laugh at them. It's also, it's wonderful when you don't take these things as your permanent essence. They're not who you are. Which means that you can totally let them go. Even my stupid sense of humour. It's not me. Please never blame me for all my bad jokes. My father was from Liverpool. He would tell his bad jokes all the time. It was in his genes, and he has bequeathed that tendency to me. It's genetic. Telling bad jokes. Not my fault. Now, what was that terrible joke he used to say? Oh yeah, about one of his friends. He got sort of in a motorbike accident. And he, unfortunately, had to have his leg amputated. This was a long time ago. They amputated the wrong leg. It does happen. And as soon as they found out, back into surgery, amputated the other leg. So, he was just so obviously upset that he took the hospital to court. He sued them. He lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on.
Some people laugh, they always shake their heads as well.
That's my father, that's conditioning. Actually, my favourite conditioning joke is there was, how many of you follow soccer? The soccer? There's a couple of you, okay. This was, Brazil used to have the best soccer team in the world. And this happened in a very poor part of Brazil. And there was one of the big fires in these big, poor parts of Rio de Janeiro. Is it Argentina or what, Maria? No, it's Brazil. In a poor part of Rio, there's a big fire, and of course the fire brigade, being so under-resourced, couldn't get there in time. And the crowd gathered, and there was a woman holding her baby, way up. And said, "Help, help!" And this fellow rushed through the crowd, and he said, "I am the Brazilian national soccer goalkeeper." No, recognize it was true. He was a goalkeeper for the Brazilian world champion soccer team. He said, "I've never let in a penalty in all my life. I've always said to everyone, throw your baby down, I'll catch it." I can't do that. Then the flames started getting high, she had no choice. So she threw her baby out the window. And the goalkeeper crouched, as they do when they're waiting for a penalty. And the baby was hurtling down to that. The crowd was silent. And then at the last minute, the baby was maybe a couple of feet to his right. And the Brazilian goalkeeper dived to his right. And he caught the baby. And the crowd went wild, cheering. Yeah, what a save. He rolled three times. And then he dropped the baby on his right foot and kicked him up the ground. That's what he'd be trained to do, conditioning. It's not true, it's only a story, so don't step into the baby abuse problem. Well, that's what conditioning does to you.
But anyway,
later on, you see through your flight cameras, nothing to do with you at all. Especially when they disappear. They vanish and get very still. They don't belong to you at all. Anyway, that's a big one. Also, in the only place for romantic relationship, is there any place for romantic relationships on the Buddhist path? And if so, how do you avoid them turning into a hindrance on the path and instead turn a relationship into a support for the practice? The whole of the practice is about relationships. The relationship of you to yourself. Being kind. Being peaceful. And also being courageous. Exploring. And after a while, this mindfulness to what it's mindful of, put peace, put kindness, put letting go between you and every object you're aware of. You don't own anything. The trouble with relationships, as many of you experience, is when you think you're owned by your significant other, controlled by them. You're not owned by anybody. You're together for a while, and then you let them go. If you're a Buddhist, you can let go pretty easily. Every relationship has its use-by date. Just like a bottle of milk. After a while, it goes sour. You can put it in the fridge, but who wants to put a relationship on ice? What do you expect? People, when they don't know the rules, they don't read the instructions, they don't take note of the expiry date, and then it's your own fault for not understanding how life works. And then afterwards, it's just there with your body. Your body's got a use by date. So what's your relationship with your body? And afterwards, what's your relationship with the mind? You find, just like any other relationship, you don't own the mind. Otherwise, you'd be able to tell what to do. There's only a couple of days left, so let's get jhana today. Mind, jhana, or you're in big trouble. Of course you can't control your mind like that. So, what's the best relationships you've ever had in your life? When no one owns one another, you trust one another, you enjoy each other's company, you allow to let them go. And you go. Greatest act of love is learning how to let go. Said that last night. But after a while you let your fly cameras go. And a wonderful time together, enjoyed each other's time, wonderful fly cameras, off you go. And they vanish and disappear. Gone forever. Oh, what bliss.
Maybe one more question, then we have a break.
Ajahn Brahm, regarding the guided meditation, I was able to hear you clearly regarding relaxing one's body, starting with the feet. However, I could not hear the latter part of the guidance regarding breath, etc. Please speak a bit loud, especially when giving guidance with meditation, metta. Okay, the reason why you couldn't hear, because you let go of the feet, you relaxed your feet, and then you relaxed your ears. So you could not hear. I tried my very best, but I can sit closer if you like. But again, if you can't hear, please say something. Or just, please put your hand up. Or please, I don't throw anything. But please actually just let me know. Give me feedback. Death. What's wrong with death? Now be serious. Why is it when a child is born, comes out of the womb, what's the first thing it does? Cries. You go to a funeral and you can't see the corpse in the box. It's smiling. The baby cries everyone else is so happy. The person in the coffin is happy and everyone else around him cries. You've got it the wrong way around. Death. I'm about to change. Okay, here we go. This is serious. I'm about to change my occupation to an SOS operator and a nurse. As such, you can be confronted with death every day. This is serious. Very lucky. This is actually getting you real. I've contemplated much about impermanence, death, or myself, my close relationships, and even my children. Though there is still one thing I find very difficult to handle, that is the thought of a small, up to 8 years of age, maybe children, losing their mother and a father, especially their father, as I'm a father. The thought of a child being left behind without a parent. And what all that can be makes me very sad. I like a way of handling those feelings, a way to think of it or contemplate over it so you don't get crushed of it by every time. It will happen, it's supposed me to be that I would care for them in those moments. It's, you all know the story when my father died, I was only 16. That's pretty young to lose one's father, but I never lost my father. I had him for 16 years. And tell people even today, what a wonderful thing it is to have someone you love and look up to and care for, even for a small time. Similarly at the concert, I would go to concert. Do you mean to concerts? When the concert's finished, you stand up, clap, shout for more. Band carries on for a little while. Then afterwards comes they have to leave. I have to leave. Never once did I feel sad after a great concert. And to rub salt into the wounds, I was there at the Marquee Club at Led Zeppelin's first performance, the concert. But she was a Led Zeppelin supporter. She actually wrote to Rod Plant and he wrote back. Yeah. So anyway. So, I go to all these great performances and I never feel sad afterwards. I met somebody they used to really, really like, the Doors, the rock bands. Remember going to the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm, and they had 2 hours of Jefferson Airplane at the time, followed by 2 hours of the Doors, another 2 hours of the Airplane, another 2 hours of the Doors. All night concert. I remember telling that to someone who just loved the Doors, and they were so jealous. How come you got to do that? Good karma. Or bad karma, one of the two. But after performances, I always would be so uplifted. Not to say, I mean, some of the great classical music performances as well. At the Albert Hall. And after that, you felt so enriched. Even though it never went on long enough. That's how I felt when my father died. Beautiful performance, thank you so much. But I was there with his son for 16 years. And he's the one who taught me open the door of your heart. And how much that I've used that over all these years as a monk. And so grateful. No sadness. Thank you for all those years. Would have missed it for the world. I gained from the time I had with my father. It wasn't a loss. When I thought what had been taken away, that could have been a loss. But when I thought what I had, that was an amazing gain. I felt so grateful. So when a kid has a mother or a son, and mother or son, kid has a mother or son, kid has a mother or father, and one of them disappears, for one reason whatsoever, can be a gain that they've had that parent for such a long time, for 4, 5, 6 years. And if you have a kid who dies when they're young, would you rather never have that kid at all? Of course not. They gave you so much love, so much kindness, so much teachings. Of course you'd have wanted it to go on for longer, but not meant to be. You're so grateful for the time you've had together. That is actually how we look at things which part. There's something really beautiful in stories like that. Everything which we have in life, we come together for a while. You appreciate every moment of it. Enjoy this retreat. A few days, I'll be going somewhere else, you'll be going somewhere else. That's our life. Make the best use of it without feeling sort of pressured that we better get it together soon, because the retreat's going in a few moments, in a few days. Instead of feeling pressure or feeling any guilt, we enjoy it while it's here, and then we go somewhere else. Cycles of existence. Regarding Arya. Oh, regarding. Oh, speak down for you. Okay, quick one. Any suggestions on how to best relate to shame? The sense that there is something fundamentally wrong with you, or you are born not enough. I realize it has arisen from conditions in my childhood. Hang around with positive people, there is nothing wrong with you, but I can say that till the cows come home. Actually, the cats never come home, people just say it again. That's what he's saying. Say that again, again, again. It doesn't really matter until you say that to yourself. You realize there is nothing special about you. You're not different than anybody else. You're as weird, eccentric. Was it? We all have our eccentricities. Mine is, and I'm fat and tell bad jokes. Other people have their other sort of eccentricities, and we try not to hide in the monastic life. Otherwise, people think, oh, we can't aspire to somebody like that. That's wonderful, actually, to all the different types of people that were in the world. I want to mention one of those monks, that Adam Simpong, who did those very loud sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. He was such a joker that one day he was staying with this very strict monk, Ajahn Mahabua. He was the strictest of monks, and the rule was if you didn't make it to the morning chanting, you couldn't eat that day. So, this monk woke up late. Wouldn't make it to the morning chanting. So what did he do? Forest monk. He's in the forest. He just found a forest chicken, a rooster. And he grabbed it. And he got a string and tied it around his poor chicken's neck. And dragged it to the hall. And it was clucking and squeaking and screeching as this Ajahn Sintong dragged it to the hall. And then after the meditation, they all heard it during the meditation after the chanting. And then when Ajahn Mahabua said, you are late, you can't go on our planet and eat today. So what do you mean late? I came before the chicken, which is an idiom in that part of the world, which means you got up early. And all the monks burst out laughing. And poor Ajahn Mahabua also giggled and said, oh, you can't do anything with this monk. Come around, bro. And he was a great joker like that. All these monks had these different characteristics, and they never tried to hide them. That was just their candors, how they manifested, but they were just way beyond those candors, but still made the path accessible for people. So yeah, you're eccentric, there's something wrong with you. Put your hand up in this room if there's something wrong with you. You didn't put your hand up.
I did.
Okay.
You can teach
him,
Miller. There's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah, I know.
So in other words, the trees in the forest, I told her so many times, go and look for a tree in the forest, everyone is bent and crooked. So the point is that you belong. You're welcome. Wonderful thing to be welcomed, to belong, without having to change yourself. Honestly, Venerable Chatter, would you like me to change myself, to go on a diet and become slim, and lies and stop telling jokes and be serious all the time? It's a package, you can't have one without the other. Of course not. It'd be unrecognisable. But every monk has, you know, got their eccentricities and so. And nuns too, got their eccentricities. They're all weird.
And in praise of weirdness.
You know, sometimes, though, at serious points, sometimes people try to actually to live into a role. They think, being a monk, you have to have a horizontal mouth. So you cannot fall asleep during meditation. Your robe has to be on perfectly. So you always have to give inspiring talks. And if you think that that's what a monk or a nun should be, you get so tight and tense. The people figure that out. You're acting a part. You're not being authentic. I think you all know that this is who I am, or who I'm not, or one of the two. Somewhere in between, I think. So that means you can relax. So that's the end of striving. Okay. Then that's. Unless you want another question before me. Actually, what time's our lunch? Okay, no, 10 minutes.
Well, you
have
to
do
10.
Okay.
There's
one last question over here. I am at a point in my life where I am considering that if I should have children or not. Leaving children cannot help with my practice. Having children will not help with my practice. Also another attachment. I also feel, what sort of a life a child would really have? I am an optimist, but trying to be as realistic as possible. On the other hand, I don't have much time left and feel I might regret not having a child. My friends point this one out very often. What do you mean you don't have much time left? You have so many lives in the future. This one can be a child-free life, and next one you have a dozen children. I don't know. When we just look at one life, you know, it makes it just so stressful. That's why I say that don't have to worry about getting in line in this life. You've got many other lives, so take it easy. Don't rush. When you take it easy and don't rush, you find that these things happen very quickly. But anyway, the many people these days, and I've seen this in some of the disciples, instead of having a child, they have what we call a fur baby. You know, they have a little cat or a dog. And if you think about it, they're far cheaper. And their love is much more unconditional than having a kid. When you want to go on a retreat, you have to get some child care. You can't put your kid in a kennel. But you can't shock. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Kids' kennels. I'm just thinking outside the box.
Kids have a kennel.
So anyway, and sometimes the people would like to have sort of somebody to love and care for in their life. And sometimes animals provide that. And there are so many even just coming in from, oh, she's not here today, from Hirati's place in Bromley, go past the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home. Every time you go past there, you think of all these poor little pooches and kittens and cats abandoned and needing a home. It's wonderful to be able to adopt one of those. They give you so much loyalty. The sort of loyalty which a kid would never give you. And it's so easy to grab and so grateful. So if you really want to learn compassion and kindness, and satisfy that part of every human being, you know, which likes to, you know, give out love and be loved, fur babies. Much easier. Anyway. Any questions or comments just before we finish up? Okay, one and two. Yeah, go on.
I have a question regarding meditation objects, because in Buddhism there is a lot of talking about body as object, breath as object, and sometimes like kasina, like visual object that you watch outside and then put into your mind. But I found that there is a nice object that I call formless kasina, or just inner eye. And with eyes closed, I just observe the visual field. And from what you were speaking about the five senses, like being covering the mind, do you think that actually any sense can be like the beginning of the meditative journey, not just the bodily sense, like the body or breath, but also the visual field? And after a while, it's like disappears this everything else, and just can it be a doorway into, in your opinion, to the mind's ear as well, or should we stick to the standard breath?
Okay, the main meditation object to be aware of is not the breath or the body or limiters or anything. It's, you know, the, if you like what I said earlier, the relationship you have between those things. What's between it? We're trying to lessen our craving, our wanting, our aversion, our ill will. So if you are just looking at some sort of inner eye, it's how are you observing that? How are you watching that? Are you trying to get something out of it? Are you trying to control it? Does it cause you ill will when it gets disturbed? Because we're trying to restrain the five hindrances. Well, what is it causing you? More tiredness, more sort of torpor, more restlessness, more doubt? Is any one of those? It's not what you're aware of, but how you are aware of it. That's a crucial feature of meditation. These other things are just like the landmarks of the journey. Landmarks of the journey, you know, you can see that you've gone past the body, you're into the time, past and present, you're into the past and future, into the present moment, past all this commentary into silence, past the silence into something like the breath. It's the landmarks are not important. It's the way you're travelling. Are you really letting go? Are you really still non-attaching? Are you aiming for something? Or are you just have this mind of renunciation and abandoning and kindness? So whatever you're aware of, it's not really the point. The point is, how are you aware of it? What's your relationship with the breath? How are you dealing with thought and torpor? What's your relationship? Do you hate it? You try desperately to get rid of it? You have sicknesses? What's your relationship with your sickness? Are you trying to get rid of it, cure it? Are you ashamed of it? That's where the cutting edge of meditation happens. Now if you do have letting go of peace, just things flow smoothly into the deep meditations. It just happens. So the type of meditation you do, what you're aware of, is not as important as how you are aware of it. No one behind.
My question is, these deep states of meditation that you describe where all the senses disappear and you go into the mind, I was wondering how are they useful in our lives outside of meditation where we have to be aware of the five senses?
How they're aware is when you're at home, your meditation gets very deep. It means you can basically have a really healthy body. You get incredible insights. And just how they can be of use in the real world or the big world outside is just still to explore that. But basically, when you do start getting into those states regularly, just you realize what we once called the real world is pretty fake.
know, people are always acting on roles, afraid of things, hiding things, trying to be somebody they're not. Here you really are getting real. So it's usually that you incline towards spiritual groups, if not monasteries, in whatever role you can do. You don't have to necessarily ordain. Many people, they live almost like a monastic life, you know, in a small house or flat. But you look at their possessions, they're so small, they don't need much. And now apparently in many parts of Europe they're having the tiny house movement. And people live in tiny little houses. We started that in monasteries a long time ago. A tiny house means you have very little housework. You don't need the TV. And the tiny house is very easy to look after. And you can have a very peaceful, beautiful life with little. So this is one of the reasons why that if you do get into these states, you don't need to prove anything to your friends by having this huge mansion, a flashy car, which is environmentally very damaging. Small houses, small car, or no car, just get the bus. A tiny Oyster car, that's all you need. And that way you can have a very peaceful, simple life. So let's move towards simplicity. That's where it leads to. Okay, so we're finishing off for now. Okay. So that was a little talk, because I know, as I said in the first talk, I do talk too much. The on and on anonymous. But it's good that it gives some instructions. And then it's 11 o'clock, so you can take a little break if you wish. And then at 12:30 is too much. But in the afternoon, because people were saying yesterday that if we came out at 1:30 for, was it guided meditation, and some of you hadn't finished your lunch yet, about 10 minutes ago. So the guided meditation at 2 o'clock. Is that okay? So you can have a leisurely lunch.
Well, actually, they do. The staff need to clean things, so it's not that they can take longer for lunch.
Okay.
So they can have a longer rest.
They've got the rest, okay. So you put the dessert in your pocket, take them out, and just eat them leisurely. Is that good for you? Probably not.
My dad did that when he was at school.
You did, yeah, did you?
He put the food he didn't like in his
pocket. Okay, anyway, so have a good afternoon, lunch, and I'll see you at 2 o'clock for guided meditation.